Now last period we started with Nehemiah and then we didn't get clear through with the story of Esther. So I'll start with Esther today and this is far more interesting and leave you to bone up Nehemiah for yourself unless we have time at the end of the day to take it up. Here is the book of Esther. If you ever have to tell a Bible story to kids of sixth grade level in vacation Bible school or someplace, the book of Esther has real possibilities. The principal villain in this story got hanged. This is a suspense story, and the suspense was 75 feet above the ground. That's suspense for you. He got hanged on a gallows 75 feet high. Now, this is during the Persian period, somewhere about the middle of that period. And the king is Ahasuerus. This is the one that is known to the Greek historians as Xerxes. And this man rules over the biggest empire the world had ever known. 127 provinces from India, and that means what we today call Pakistan, to Ethiopia, and this means the Sudan just south of Egypt. Tremendous sprawling belt of territory. The world had never had that much before under one government or one flag. And when he's been king for 3 years, he puts on a big jubilee celebration for important people from all over this tremendous empire. This feast and sort of an expo, expo 3 for his 3rd year of his reign lasts 180 days, half a year. And it is held at Susa, or in the Bible, Shushan. Now, Susa was not the real capital of the Persian Empire. The real capital was Persepolis. This was burned later by Alexander the Great. The story in Plutarch and other ancient historians is that one of Alexander's lady friends, to whom, incidentally, he was not properly married, said to him she hadn't seen a real good fire for quite a spell, and to please her, he burned Persepolis, the beautiful capital of the Persian Empire. Historians doubt that story about his lady friend. There's no doubt, however, he burned Persepolis. That was later than what we're dealing with today, though, 100 years or more later. So here we are. Anyhow, Susa is a branch capital, something like President Nixon's California White House. And this is where the scene of the action is at this particular time. Now, Susa has been thoroughly excavated by archaeologists just a few years ago, a little bit before our time, but not very long ago. They did not find direct evidence confirming the Book of Esther. That is, they didn't find the bones of Esther or anything like that. But they found a great deal of background material, and one conclusion from archaeological digging at Susa is that this Book of Esther could only have been written by somebody who had lived there. The description of the royal palace and its pavements and so forth is too close to what was discovered for this to have been put up by just a literary imagination. Therefore, this book obviously was written by a person who lived or had lived at Shushan or Susa. Now, the people gather in and they have this big celebration with meetings and, you know, honors bestowed and all sorts of things going on half a year. At the end of this length of time, there's a special feast held for 1 week, 7 days, for especially important people. In the grounds of the king's palace, it describes the luxury surroundings, the tapestries and the pavements, and it says their drinking was in gold goblets of which no two were alike. And the drinking was according to law. None could compel. That is, you couldn't be compelled to drink more than you wanted, but by the same token, you could also not be compelled to drink less than you wanted. 7 days. Now, meantime, Vashti the queen is holding a ladies' party on another part of the palace grounds. It was not considered proper to have a mixed party of men and women. This simply wasn't done. So Vashti is holding a ladies' party for women of high rank and standing. Incidentally, Vashti was not the real queen either. Her name was Amethyst. The real queen, who was the king's original wife and mother of the heir to the throne, was not Vashti, but she is the king's favorite at this time and is called the queen by him, Vashti. And evidently a very beautiful woman. Now, after 7 days of drinking according to the law, Mr. Thompson, do you suppose the king was somewhat under the influence? Now, he wasn't clear crossed, you know, or stoned, but certainly under the influence. And when people get under the influence of alcoholic inebriation, they have the dumbest ideas and think they're smart. I saw a cartoon of a fellow on his hands and knees at night under a streetlight poking around in the grass, and a policeman came and says, "What's the matter with you?" "Officer, I lost 50 cents." "Where'd you lose it?" "Over there, across the street." "What are you looking for here for?" "Officer, dark over there." And another one, late at night, in the dark, trying to poke a key into a keyhole of a house and couldn't get it in. And the cop came past and said, "What's the matter with you? Can't you get the door open?" "Officer, you see them houses swirling around? When mine comes past, I'm going to put my key in the keyhole." No, I'm afraid that's only too true to life. And here the king has the dumbest idea and thinks it's smart. The evidence indicates the king was very fond of Vashti and loved her, and if he'd have been sober, he would never have humiliated her like he tried to do here. But you see, he isn't sober. He's drunk. Now, I say he wasn't crock, but he's certainly drunk. And so he gets this crazy idea, absolutely contrary to Persian propriety. "I'll send for Esther the queen and parade her around in here to show off her charms and beauty to my gentleman guests." So he sends two court officers to the ladies' banquet to get us to get Vashti. "What?" "The king requires your presence at the men's banquet." "What? Me go in there and be stared at by all those drunk men? I should say not. I refuse to go." This is understandable. She was absolutely within her rights. I will say that my sympathies in this story are very much with Esther. She gets with Vashti, she gets the bummest deal of anybody in this book. "I refuse to go. These officers come back and tell the king. We told her, but she wouldn't come." And this makes the king furious. These Persian kings are autocratic oriental despots. They're not used to anybody saying no to anything they want done. And the queen of all people refuses to come when sent for. And he's furious. His court officers have long ago learned when he's in that kind of a mood, you smooth him down. You don't argue with him. You don't contradict him of all things. You kind of tone him down by agreeing with everything he says. So they agree with him. He says, "What shall be done to Vashti who refused to obey the king's command?" "King, Vashti has done a terrible wrong, not only to the king, but to all the married men in the Persian Empire. When the ladies hear about this, there'll be no living with them. Women's lib will have begun in the Persian Empire." The king sent for her and she refused to obey. All right, all the women and wives of people in the Persian Empire will no longer either respect or obey their husbands. This will be just awful. Therefore, Vashti must be deposed from her honor and somebody else chosen in her place. Right, done. So poor Vashti, she gets kicked upstairs to the third floor of the home for superannuated women. And that's that. Sorry for her, but that's the way it was. And after a while, the king is lonely, and evidently he was detached to Vashti, and sorry he'd lost her this way, but the Persian king couldn't change his decree. So he decides to hold an empire-wide beauty contest to elect Miss Shushan of that year, who will be the next queen and favorite of the king in place of Vashti. Now, this was not done according to principles of American democracy. The talent scouts went out, and when they found somebody they thought would be a likely candidate, they nabbed them. And there wasn't much free will in this. Now, at this point, Esther appears in the story. A Jewish girl, and had been left an orphan in early childhood. And her cousin, Mordecai, some call him her uncle, really her cousin, much older than she, probably old enough to be her father, maybe even her grandfather, and a rich man. There she is right there. A rich man and much older than Esther had adopted her as his daughter, although she was his cousin and an orphan, and had brought her up as his daughter and given her a home. This was the deed, of course, on his part. And Esther gets drafted into this beauty contest and wins the honors. Miss Shushan. I suppose she had a natural beauty of the kind that you don't buy at the drugstore, but that comes by nature. And you know, I don't know, the movie industry will someday make a movie of the story of Ruth and the story of Esther, and they'll spoil it. They'll have Esther there smoking a cigarette or something. But anyhow, Esther wins the honor. Now you might wonder, what is a Jewish maiden that believes in God doing, getting into a situation like this, where she is surely going to get involved in a polygamous marriage, be married to a fraction of a husband, let's say, and probably into situations that will compromise her conscience and religious faith, or at least that she'll get out of with difficulty. In answer to this, the book of Esther was certainly not written and put in the Bible to teach us moral lessons about polygamy and mixed marriages. The Bible says plenty about these things other places, and you can form your own judgment on it on that basis. This book was very obviously written with a single purpose, to show the amazing providence of God in saving the Jews from mass destruction. And that's the purpose of it. And secondly, Esther seems to have been drafted and therefore not to have had any choice, therefore she should not be blamed. Now, she goes into the king's palace, women's part of it. And Mordecai can't see her anymore. No men were ever allowed in the women's quarters. And they weren't even allowed in the men's part of the royal palace unless they'd been sent for. So Mordecai is out of connection now with his adopted daughter Esther. He goes every day. Remember, he's an elderly man, probably retired and wealthy, and sits on a bench in the service entrance to the royal palace. Now, this would be a great big yard, a courtyard. Back of the royal palace, there would be benches and potted palm trees and little flower gardens and messenger boys coming and going and the grocer's cart coming up with the groceries and so forth all the time. And day after day, Mordecai goes and sits there. Incidentally, his name, although he is Jewish, has the Babylonian god Marduk as part of his name, Mordecai. Now, he sits there and picks up scraps of information about how Esther's getting along from the servants that are going in and out, what she can do. And one day, Mordecai is sitting there, and some little distance away, perhaps in a doorway, there are two Persians. These are not two common Persians. They're Persians of high rank and on the king's payroll. And he recognizes them and knows who they are. And they are talking in subdued voice in the Persian language. And Mordecai listens. Now imagine he's blinking in the sunshine under a potted palm tree and sort of leaning back, you know, and blinking. And this conversation, he hears it. It's a plot to lay hands on the king. Now this means to assassinate the king. It's just a nice way of saying it, lay hands on the king. This doesn't mean give him a good shaking or something like that. It means to kill him. You either leave a Persian king completely alone or you kill him thoroughly at the first try. Anything between these is very dangerous. So this is a plot to assassinate the king. And one of these Persians looks over towards Mordecai with a question mark on his face. And the other one nods his head and says, nope, he's asleep. And besides that, he's a Jew, he wouldn't understand our language. But Mordecai does. And he gets all the details fixed in his mind. They leave and go home. It's a plot to kill the king. After they're gone, Mordecai gets this written down and sends the papyrus or whatever it was into Esther, and she turns it over to the Persian FBI that investigates it, and it's found to be true, and these two fellows are hanged, and it's recorded in the records of the kingdom. Now, the next character appears. This is Haman. Haman is not a real Persian. He's a foreigner, but perhaps his family lived there a long time. A stuffed shirt, if there is one in the Old Testament. Haman is a person completely lacking in all character and nobility. Absolutely a self-seeking fool. But he's got the king completely buffaloed and hypnotized. The king will hardly do anything important without consulting Haman. Haman can get anything he wants just by asking the king. And of all people, he's got a day and night pass into the royal palace. This is Haman. And Haman is definitely the king's favorite. And here everybody is ordered to bow when Haman comes out, or when he goes in, and they all do, except Mordecai, who sits in his seat and won't even get up. It isn't clear why he refused to rise and bow when Haman went out. This did not imply any religious honor. This was simply a civil honor. If the President of the United States would walk into one of our convocations in Matheny Field, I expect we'd stand up for him. And that you wouldn't, Mr. Wenger, not the rest of us. But I see you nodding if you wouldn't. Oh, okay, all right. You're Republican. You're Republican. Yeah, all right. This did not imply any recognition of divine honor or compromise. It was just a civil sort of a courtesy, but Mordecai won't do it. Maybe he sees through the emptiness of the character of this man Haman and will not lower himself by bowing to a man like that. It burns Haman up. This Jew, this one Jew, the only person that won't bow when I come out. I'll fix him. I'll have him killed. But say, wait a minute. We people of the Haman clan don't do anything in a small way. He's a Jew, is he? Okay. I'll have them all put to death throughout the empire. Now, Haman knows very well he can't go in to see King Ahasuerus and say, there's one Jew out here that won't get up and bow when I come past. Please, Your Majesty, I'd like to have all the Jews in the empire put to death for that. He knows the king won't do that. So he's got to think up something else. Haman goes to the fortune teller. Pick me out a lucky day. I'm telling you, it was a lucky day for the fortune tellers of Susa when Mordecai wouldn't bow to Haman. They made their fortune out of this. Pick me out a lucky day. It isn't clear whether this was a lucky day for the Jews to be killed, or a lucky day for Haman to go and talk to the king, possibly the latter. But they juggle their little bamboo sticks and look at their books of magic lore and, sorry, sir, it just doesn't seem to work out this morning for some reason. Come tomorrow, we'll try again. Maybe the omens will be auspicious tomorrow, and that'll be $50 for this morning, sir. So he pays, and goes the next day, and this goes on and on, day after day, for a long time. They're really making their money out of this. And, of course, Haman's got plenty of money. Finally, however, they decide maybe their luck's going to wear a little bit thin. Maybe they better not stretch this too far. So they come up with a lucky day, and Haman goes in to see the king. Your Majesty, there's a people scattered throughout your dominions that are different from everybody else. Matter of fact, they're unassimilable. Their laws and customs are different from other people. And it isn't a good idea to let them live. Let's say it's undemocratic to let them live. So please let them be destroyed, and I, Haman, will pay into the king's treasury 10,000 talents of silver. Now, Haman is rich. He could do this. You see, many Jews by this time were prosperous, and some were very rich, and they paid very substantial taxes to the government. And if they're going to be killed, well, then they won't pay any more taxes after that. So Haman here is offering to reimburse the government's treasury for the lost taxes. Now, Haman is rich, but the king is much richer. The king takes off his ring, signet ring that he signed a decree with. Here, Haman, my friend, take this ring. The people are given to you, and the silver also. Thanks. Haman goes out to the room where the scribes are and has the decree written, it's in Persian and other languages, naming the date almost a year in advance on which the Jews are to be killed, old and young, male and female, down to newborn babies, all to be killed. And there's a built-in gimmick to get it done. Those who do the killing can take the property of the victims to pay them for their trouble. This goes on the bulletin board at Susa and by Pony Express to more distant places. Haman goes in to eat dinner with the king, very pleased, and the city of Susa was perplexed, so it says. Now then, Mordecai reads that bulletin board, and he goes into high gear. He conducts a one-man demonstration and protest march. It's quite modern, you know. He takes off his good clothes and puts on some old dirty gunny sacks off the garage floor someplace and puts ashes on his head and goes up and down the streets of Susa with an exceeding loud and bitter cry. This is an attention getter. Then he sits down with the sackcloth and ashes on him in the dirt of the street just outside the entrance to the royal palace. Nobody was allowed inside looking like he looked or dressed like he was. But he goes as near as he can. Somebody goes in and tells Esther, your cousin Mordecai is sitting out there with sackcloth and ashes in the dirt of the road. She sends out some clean, good clothes, and he sends them back and says, I don't want them, and sends her a copy of the decree from the bulletin board, and pleads with her to go in and see the king and plead for the life of her people. Esther sends word out, I don't dare to do it. Now, the Persians were terribly afraid of kings being assassinated, and they had a rule that nobody but nobody was allowed to come near the king's presence that hadn't been sent for within 30 days. And Esther said, I haven't been sent for within 30 days. This will cost me my life. How would any of you young ladies like to be married to a man that might have your head chopped off for walking into the room where he was without being sent for? That's not my idea of a very lovey-dovey marriage. Anyhow, this was the rule. Even the queen didn't dare. And Mordecai sends word back and says, look, how do you know but what you came to the kingdom for such a time as this? In other words, there's a purpose of God in your being here. If you don't rise to this occasion, help will come to the Jews from some other source, but you and your relatives will perish. Now, Esther shows she is not only beautiful, but also brave. Gather all the Jews together for 3 days fasting. This implies praying also. And I and my maidens will do the same, and after 3 days, without having been sent for, I will go in and see the king. So she is brave as well as beautiful. The 3 days fast, the praying and fasting has been done. She gets dressed up in her absolutely finest and goes and stands in the entryway to the king's throne room. Now, the Persians had a rule, if the king holds out his golden scepter, you don't get your head chopped off. And he sees Esther there and is smitten with affection, let's say, for her, and holds out the golden scepter and says, Queen Esther, what is your request? It shall be granted to the half of the kingdom. Now, you aren't supposed to ask for the half of the kingdom. But this is how Persian kings like to talk. It builds a guy's ego up, you know, to talk big like this. My request is, if it please the king, that the king and Haman come to a banquet that I have planned for tomorrow night in the queen's apartments. Granted. So a messenger goes to inform Haman. He's invited to a banquet with the king and the queen that evening. Now, Haman is all set up. This is a new honor. He never had this before. And when the banquet comes, here they are. They're just Esther and King Ahasuerus and Haman. They didn't sit at tables like we do at a banquet. They had sofas that were angled parked with your head toward the table where the food was and your feet out at an angle. They used to recline this way. This is called relaxed eating. You try it in the bridge someday, or you better still in the dining hall. Like that. And maybe the servants almost put the food in your mouth, too. That's how they work. And the king, you know, is just all bitten by curiosity. What's bugging Esther anyhow? What does she want? Queen Esther, now what is your request? It shall be granted to the half of the kingdom. This time Esther proves she's not only beautiful and brave, but also smart. She's going to build up the king's curiosity. If it please the king, my request is that the king and Haman come to another banquet planned for tomorrow night in this same place. Grant it. Haman goes home, and is he proud? Oh, calls in Zeresh, his wife, and his children, and his friends and relatives, and makes a bragging speech. Lists his real estate, stocks, bonds, honors, and titles. And then says, and on top of all this, I, Haman, your husband and father and neighbor, was the only guest at a banquet with the king and the queen, and on top of that, I, Haman, your husband, father, and neighbor, am to be the only guest again tomorrow night at a banquet with the king and the queen. But all this is ashes in my mouth as long as I see the Jew Mordecai at the entrance to the royal palace, and he will not get up and bow when I come in or out. Zeresh says, Haman, my husband, don't let that get you down. Have a gallows made 50 cubits high, that's 75 feet, and get Mordecai hanged on it and get it over with. And then go in merrily to the queen's banquet. Capital, I'll get it done. Now remember, Haman's got all the money he needs. He calls in carpenters and agents from the lumber yards to work through the night. They're putting up an oil well derrick there, 75 feet high. Haman sits there watching. Juicy. Lovely. 75 feet. That's where Mordecai's going to be hanging by tomorrow this time. I'm probably going to leave him up there till the birds peck his bones. Mordecai, up there on the top of that. Oh, boy. Now, they get it finished. Pays the carpenters off. And he can't even wait till daylight to go in and ask the king to have Mordecai hanged. Meanwhile, that night the king couldn't get to sleep. Now, you know, phenobarbital, salmonex, nitrol, counting sheep, they didn't have any of these ways. But when the king couldn't sleep, they called a scribe in to read the records of the kingdom. This is so dry, it put anybody to sleep. Here's the king, he can't sleep on his jasmine scented four-poster bed with his silk pillows and bolsters, can't sleep. And the scribe is brought in and starts to read at the king's bedside. The statistics of the salt tax revenue for the previous year from the different provinces. That isn't dry, you know. It's dry as talcum powder. That doesn't put you to sleep. You're a bad case. And all of a sudden, the scribe reads something that electrifies the king. A plot was discovered to assassinate the king. It was reported by Mordecai the Jew, investigated, found to be true, and the two principal villains were hanged, and it was ordered, recorded in the annals of the kingdom. Now go on, what does it say after that? What reward was given to Mordecai for that? Your Majesty, it goes back to the salt tax. It doesn't say any more about that. Well, that's funny. He should have had a reward. At this point, there's a door knocking outside in the corridor. Says to one of the servants, go see who that is. So it comes back, Haman, Your Majesty. Oh, Haman, bring him in. So Haman is brought in here maybe 1, 2 o'clock in the morning to the king's bedside. Haman, my friend, you came at just the right time. We need your counsel. Haman, what do you think? What shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?
Haman thinks, of course that's me. I'll lay it on real thick. Well, I suggest for the man whom the king delights to honor that the following be done. That the king's royal crown be put on his head. Talk about nerve, you know. And they be given the king's best robe to wear and mounted on the king's best special war horse. And one of the king's most noble princes lead him up and down for one day through the streets and avenues of Susa, shouting in front of him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Capital Haman, I couldn't have thought of a better plan myself. Now, Haman, the man whom the king delights to honor is Mordecai the Jew, who saved the king's life. And you, Haman, are one of the king's most noble princes. I hereby appoint you to carry this plan out. And we'll have the servants check out the crown, the robe, and the horse for you. And mind, Haman, you don't omit any of those little details. Now, Haman eats crow.
He'd have gladly dropped through a crack in the floor if he could, but he doesn't dare to disobey the king.
And don't anybody tell you there's no humor in the Bible. This is one of the most ridiculous scenes in all literature. Haman goes out come daybreak, and here's Mordecai sitting there under the potted palm tree. "Top of the morning to you, sir. The king's orders, sir. Permit me to adjust this gold crown to your head, sir. Now, sir, let's try on this purple velvet robe. Yes, sir. Now, sir, put your foot in this stirrup. I'll assist you to mount this charger." So he gets him up on the horse, and Haman gets a hold of the bridle and starts leading him through the street, shouting in front of him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Now, you know, Haman and Mordecai were both publicly known figures. People knew them by name and by sight. And this would be the joke of the century in Susa. When this procession gets past, just imagine the snickers and the laughs. Did you see that? That's Mordecai up on that horse. And there's Haman leading him around and shouting. Did you see that? And they would never get over telling this one on Haman. All right, finally that awful day is over. Poor Haman, you know. Talk about losing faith. That awful day. He goes back to the royal palace and checks in the horse, the crown, and the robe. And Haman, looking like a puppy dog that's been spanked, goes home and he thinks, "Zeresh loves me. She'll comfort me." That's his wife's name. Not Zeresh, Zeresh. "She loves me." And he goes home and tells her, thinking she'll comfort him. You know, a man's wife ought to give him a little comfort sometimes. And he tells that story, and she says, "Haman, my husband, I'm afraid it looks bad for you. I'm afraid you've had it, Haman. If this Mordecai is of the kindred of the Jews, okay, Haman, too bad about you, but you're done for. This kind of comfort we can do without." Now, Haman is so mad, he has forgotten the queen's second banquet for that evening. And a chariot arrives from the royal palace to take him to it. He has to get cleaned up and dressed up in an awful hurry, but he does. And he goes to the palace, and there they are again in the same place, seated with on or reclining on divans or sofas to the dinner table. And the king says, "Queen Esther, now what is your request? It shall be granted to the half of the kingdom." Esther gets off that sofa and down on her knees on the floor and holds her hands up like this in front of the king and says in a piteous wailing voice, "If it please the king, my request is that I be allowed to stay alive. We are sold to be slain, I and my people. If we were only sold to be slaves, I wouldn't have said anything, but we are sold to be slain, I and my people." And the king, poor fellow, can't figure it out. "Who is it that is dares to suggest such a thing? The enemies of wicked Haman!" At this point, the king is so angry he can't talk. He chokes, gets up and walks out into the flower garden, the rose garden, back of the royal palace to walk back and forth to get his blood pressure down again. And Haman thinks, "Boy, it doesn't look so good, does it?" And he gets up and goes around to the foot of this place where Queen Esther is reclining and gets on his knees and thinks, "If Esther is a woman, she'll have a kind heart. She will spare my life. I will plead with Esther to spare my life." So he gets around there and kneels on the ground and reaches up and takes a hold of her feet with both hands to plead for his life. At this point, the king comes back in and misreads the scene. Does he dare to try to rape the queen right here in the royal palace too? How does he dare to touch the queen? At this point, Haman gets up and starts to blink. And one of the servants pops a pillowcase over his head. This is what they did for condemned criminals. You're supposed to be so ashamed you won't look anybody in the face. Pop a pillowcase on his head. And one of the servants says to the king, "Your Majesty, did you know that in the backyard of Haman's mansion there's a gallows made last night 50 cubits high on which he intends to have Mordecai the Jew hang?" "There is, sir. Hang him on it." This is the indictment, the arraignment, the trial, the verdict, and the sentence all in one. They did it with a minimum of red tape in ancient Persia. So the procession goes through the streets from the royal palace to Haman's headquarters, with Haman walking along with a pillowcase over his head. And as they go through the street, there are more and more people gather in, you know. This is one of these things that draws a crowd. Meanwhile, Zeresh is waiting there, thinking, I'm going to see Mordecai hang, this man that insults my husband every day. He's going to be up there at the top of that gallows. Now, I'm not sure that Zeresh herself was very respectful to her husband, only just a jiffy, but she won't stand for somebody else to insult her husband. But when they get there, of all things, it is Haman that gets hanged on his own gallows, and you can read the rest of the story, the Jews are saved.